From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
My attacks on the Watergate break-in hurt me. I would have lifetime Democrats stop me on the street or in airports or hotel lobbies and say, George, I'm all for you, but I think you've gone too far in calling this administration corrupt. You can't call the President of the United States a corrupt.
Deep Throat Revealed. Today, we look at Mark Felt, the FBI official who helped bring down Richard Nixon by leaking details of the Watergate break-in to the Washington Post. We speak with Nixon's 1972 challenger, George McGovern, and former Senator Mike Gravel, who put the Pentagon Papers on the congressional record. We'll also look at how Deep Throat was convicted for ordering FBI agents to illegally break into the apartments of friends and family of the Weather Underground. In a Democracy Now! Exclusive, we'll be joined in our studio by Jennifer Dorn, a frequent target of the break-ins ordered by Mark Felt.
I was the target of numerous break-ins, wiretapping, following, harassment during the early 1970s. Which were directed and authorized by Mark Felt, who has now revealed himself as Deep Throat, the source of the Watergate break-ins.
And we'll talk to investigative journalist David Wise, author of The American Police State and the Politics of Lying. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, three suicide car bombs killed at least 16 people and wounded more than 50 others early this morning. One attack targeted bodyguards for a deputy prime minister. Another went after a U.S. diplomatic convoy, and the third killed a political leader in Bakuba. Two more U.S. soldiers were killed, bringing the number of U.S. troops killed in Iraq to 1,666. This comes as the Los Angeles Times is reporting suicide bombings have risen dramatically over the past several months. The paper says 90 suicide attacks account for most of last month's 750 deaths. The Times says that suicide attacks outpaced car bombings almost 2-1 in May, and that in April there were more suicide attacks than in the entire year preceding the June 28th handover. Meanwhile, a lawyer for Saddam Hussein called on the Iraqi government to bring formal charges against the ousted Iraqi leader if it expects to put him on trial this summer. This comes a day after the president of Iraq's transitional government, Jalal Talabani, said he hopes to see Saddam tried within 2 months. In a glimpse of one of Saddam's possible defenses, his lawyer said forensic tests indicate the chemicals used against the Kurds in Halabja in 1988, quote, certainly did not come from Iraq. He did not elaborate. Now to the so-called UN oil for food scandal. Secretary General Kofi Annan has fired his first UN official in the controversy. The official, Joseph Stefanidis, was a longtime UN diplomat. He was accused by a UN-appointed inquiry of steering a lucrative contract under the Oil for Food program to a British firm. He denied breaking any rules and vowed to appeal. Stefanidis said, quote, there were tremendous pressures to cut corners and accelerate the institutional arrangements because civilians were suffering in Iraq, and Oil for Food had to be started as soon as possible to make me the fall guy for that. This is really preposterous, he said. In other Iraq news, the United States, the European Union, and Iraq announced an international conference on Iraq. It'll be held in Brussels, Belgium, on June 22nd. Voters in the Netherlands dealt a potentially fatal blow to the European Constitution, delivering a massive no vote just 3 days after it was rejected by the French. Nearly two-thirds of Dutch voters wanted the treaty thrown out. Analysts say the Dutch vote was the result of a combination of factors, some economic and others political. Here is Socialist Party Member of Parliament, Christa van Velven.
Well, first of all, this is the first time in 50 years that the Dutch people have been asked anything about the European Union. So they've been forced to take all the treaties, including the introduction of the euro, which people are quite angry about. This is the first time ever they've been asked to say anything.
Dutch Member of Parliament Christa van Velven. The Dutch vote on the Constitution caused the euro to drop even lower, and Europe's leaders will hold a summit later this month to try to contain the turmoil. The summit's likely to extend the November 2006 deadline for ratification in the hope that French and Dutch voters change their minds. Britain's now expected to cancel its planned referendum, and others, including Ireland, the Czech Republic, and Poland, could follow. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld spent a good part of his news conference yesterday attacking the human rights group Amnesty International. He called the group's description of the Guantanamo prison as a gulag, quote, reprehensible. Rumsfeld said, quote, most would define a gulag as where the Soviet Union kept millions in forced labor concentration camps, or I suppose some might say where Saddam Hussein mutilated and murdered untold numbers because they held views unacceptable to his regime. To compare the United States and Guantanamo Bay to such atrocities cannot be excused, Rumsfeld said. Amnesty issued a statement noting in the early weeks of the Iraq War, Rumsfeld at least three times cited Amnesty's account of human rights violations by Iraq's then president, Saddam Hussein. The head of Amnesty USA, Bill Schultz, said, quote, 20 years ago, Amnesty International was criticized Saddam Hussein's human rights abuses at the same time Donald Rumsfeld was courting him. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear a full debate that we had with William Schultz, director of Amnesty International USA, yesterday on the program. Meanwhile, more stories of torture and abuse continue to come out of Guantanamo. The first Kuwaiti to be released from the U.S.-run prison charged yesterday, he was subjected to psychological torture at Guantanamo. 11 Kuwaitis are known to be at the prison. In Lebanon, a prominent newspaper journalist was killed in a car bomb in a residential area of East Beirut. The journalist, Samir Khazir, was known as a supporter of Lebanon's anti-Syria opposition. He's the most prominent Lebanese figure to be assassinated since former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri was killed in February. President Bush made clear yesterday he's opposed to doubling aid for Africa. That's one of the major proposals on the agenda for a summit meeting of industrial nations next month in Scotland. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has proposed that the world's richest nations make a $25 billion increase in support for Africa. But asked about the issue yesterday, Bush said, quote, it doesn't fit our budgetary process. Israel's begun the release of about 400 Palestinian prisoners as part of the second phase of the prisoner releases promised under a ceasefire agreement between Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. About 500 Palestinian prisoners were freed in the first phase in late February. Massive protests continue to rock Bolivia and are spreading well beyond the capital, La Paz. A planned session of the country's Congress was postponed for a second straight day, and indigenous-led protests have blockaded roads in various areas of the country. Jim Schultz of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba is now reporting the country's heading for what he calls a national shutdown. Several governments, including the U.S., have issued travel warnings for Bolivia. Meanwhile, one of the most prominent opposition figures, Evo Morales, is warning that right-wing forces in the country may attempt to seize power in a military coup in an effort to prevent the indigenous-led protesters from bringing down the U.S.-backed government and taking power. At the center of the protests is the rights of the country's majority indigenous population. In Haiti, France's honorary consul to the country was shot and killed by a group of men who pulled him from his vehicle and stole his car. The killing comes less than a week after the U.S., French, and Canadian governments issued travel warnings for Haiti, citing deteriorating security conditions and an upsurge in carjackings and kidnappings. The Venezuelan government yesterday formally protested the U.S. decision not to hand over the Cuban-born terror suspect Luis Posada Cariles and said it would continue to seek his extradition. The Venezuelan embassy in Washington said in a press statement that it sent a note to the U.S. State Department protesting the U.S. decision not to put Posada under preventive detention. He's currently in U.S. custody on unrelated immigration charges. The embassy said it would present more information to Washington to back up its extradition request. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said last month Caracas could cut diplomatic ties with the U.S. unless Posada was turned over to Venezuela to face trial. The Pentagon has postponed by more than a week the release of military recruiting figures for May, as the Army and Marine Corps continue to face the worst recruiting crisis in their history. The military usually provide recruiting statistics on the first of every month. Asked whether the move was simply delaying the release of bad news, a military spokesperson said, quote, "That's not necessarily true." The music band Nine Inch Nails has pulled out of the MTV Movie Awards after clashing with the network over an image of President Bush that the band planned as a performance backdrop. The image was to accompany the song The Hand That Feeds, which criticizes the occupation of Iraq. MTV said in a statement it would have been, quote, uncomfortable with their performance being built around a partisan political statement. The leader of Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor, said on the band's website that the image of Bush would have been unaltered. Reznor said, quote, "Apparently, the image of our president is as offensive to MTV as it is to me." You're keeping in step. The Hand That Feeds by Nine Inch Nails, the song that won't be sung at the MTV Awards. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you out there in broadcast land and listening in on the Internet. One of the great mysteries of American politics appears to have been solved, the identity of Deep Throat, the secret source that helped the Washington Post unravel the Watergate scandal. The June 1972 break-in at the Democratic National Headquarters in the Watergate office building eventually forced President Nixon to resign in order to avoid impeachment. In addition, more than 30 government and Republican campaign officials were convicted of charges that included perjury, burglary, wiretapping, and obstruction of justice. For over 30 years, the Washington Post reporters who broke the story, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, refused to identify their source. They had vowed they would keep it secret until the source's death.
But on Tuesday, the secret came out. Not in the pages of the Washington Post, but the monthly magazine Vanity Fair. Deep Throat is Mark Felt, the number two man in J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. He's 91 years old, living in California. His family had asked an attorney by the name of John D. O'Connor to share his story that appeared in Vanity Fair. In today's Washington Post, Bob Woodward reveals he first met Felt in 1970 by chance at the White House. At the time, the 27-year-old Woodward was still serving in the Navy and had yet decided to pursue a career in journalism. Felt, he said, became a friend and mentor. He also became Woodward's most important source for his biggest story ever.
Today we will look at the impact of Watergate 30 years later, as well as the man who turned out to be Deep Throat. Later in the program, we will examine Mark Felt's connection to the FBI's counterintelligence campaign known as COINTELPRO and the hunt for the Weather Underground. But first, we'll look at the break-in of the Watergate Hotel and how Mark Felt became Deep Throat. Most Americans only know Deep Throat from the 1976 Oscar-winning movie All the President's Men, starring Robert Redford as Bob Woodward and Dustin Hoffman as Carl Bernstein. In the film, Deep Throat is portrayed by Hal Holbrook. This is a pivotal scene from the movie where Deep Throat is helping Woodward understand the Watergate scandal extends all the way into the Oval Office. He also tells Woodward that Nixon's goal was to sabotage viable Democratic candidates.
Don't you understand what you're on to?
Mitchell knew?
Of course, Mitchell knew. Do you think something this size just happens?
Haldeman had to know, too.
You get nothing from me about Haldeman.
Segretti said that.
Don't concentrate on Segretti. You'll miss the overall.
The letter that destroyed the Muskie candidates, the Knuckle. Did that come from inside the way?
You're missing the overall.
But what overall?
They were frightened of Muskie, and look who got destroyed. They wanted to run against McGovern. Look who they're running against. They bugged. They followed people. False press leaks, fake letters. They canceled Democratic campaign rallies. They investigated Democratic private lives. They planted spies, stole documents, and on. Now, don't tell me you think this is all the work of little Don Segretti.
A scene from the 1976 film All the President's Men, Deep Throat, speaking to Bob Woodward. We're joined now by former Senator George McGovern. He ran against Richard Nixon for president in 1972, joins us on the phone. We're also joined by former Senator Mike Gravel of Alaska, who was also serving in the Senate at the time of the Watergate break-in, who joins us in our Washington studio. Senator George McGovern, let's begin with you. Especially for the younger generation who's listening and watching right now, can you explain what Watergate was all about, the significance, and your response to the fact that it is Mark Felt, Deep Throat?
Well, Watergate really began, as far as the public is concerned, with the first news report that on June 19th, 1972, seven men were caught in the middle of the night in Democratic headquarters, rifling our files. They came in equipped with burglar tools, with rubber gloves, all the stealth of a professional break-in. They had taped open the doors of the Democratic National Committee so they could move in silently and move out silently. But they were caught by an alert guard who noticed the taping on the doors. And the next morning, the story broke that seven people, apparently from the Nixon White House or the Nixon campaign command, had executed this deal. I remember vividly the story. It was a small, single-column story on the front page of the Washington Post, maybe 5 or 6 inches long. Not much in the way of detail, and that started off a revelation that eventually was to lead, about a year and a half after the election, to the expulsion of Mr. Nixon from the White House. But it was a highly secretive operation carried out by a crew of men, one of whom was found carrying a White House pass right from the beginning. I assume that it was ordered from the top of the Nixon campaign or the Nixon White House.
And can you talk, sir, about the what it was like in Congress at the time as the story was evolving? And many people looking back now assume that everyone united against Nixon in terms of his involvement in this. But what was it like for you as a senator trying to unearth what was going on?
Well, of course, I was an announced candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. I'd already won a series of primary elections. This was almost exactly 1 month before our Democratic National Convention in Miami, Florida, where I actually officially won the Democratic nomination. So obviously I had a special interest in this because there appeared to be a conspiracy here. We didn't know why they broke into our headquarters. There were various explanations gave. I always had a hunch, and it's nothing more than a hunch because we don't really have clear evidence of what they were after at our headquarters, that Nixon thought we must have had some information on him that we would use at a strategic point during the campaign, and probably had his people trying to find out what it was. It may be that they thought there was information that would be embarrassing to us.
We don't really know that answer. There may be some people who know specifically what they were doing in our headquarters that night, but I've never known for sure what their motive was. One of the interesting things about it is that the story had a splash for a few days, and then it seemed to kind of die out. The national media really didn't pick up on it all that much. I remember wondering at the time why that was not a major investigative story for the networks, for the metropolitan newspapers, for the national press as a whole. But it never got the attention at the time that I thought it deserved, nor did it get that attention during the forthcoming campaign. I used to talk about it in virtually every speech, but I must say, outside of these two cub reporters at the Washington Post who were working on the municipal desk, not on the national desk, the national media never really got into that story until after the 1972 election, 5 months later.
We're talking to Senator George McGovern, who ran against Richard Nixon. Again, the Watergate break-in a month before he was nominated to be the Democratic candidate. In the excerpt we just heard from All the President's Men, the conversation between Deep Throat and Bob Woodward, Woodward's raising the issue of Don Segretti, who was involved in these dirty tricks during the various Democratic primaries. Deep Throat saying to him that it was about bringing down Muskie so that Nixon could run for you. Nixon could run against you, McGovern.
That may have been one of their motives. I don't know. By that stage, I had defeated Muskie in a whole series of primaries, including the two biggest ones, New York and California, and other significant primaries such as New Jersey, Massachusetts, Wisconsin, Oregon. We had won some 11 primaries by that stage. So it was quite clear, at least among voters who were participating in those large primaries, and that totaled up to millions of people, that I was the strongest candidate. When the campaign began, months before, it looked like Hubert Humphrey or Ed Muskie would be the stronger contenders. They had been our nominees for president and vice president in 1968. They were older than I. They'd been in politics longer. They were on the national scene longer. So I suppose it might be concluded by some of the insiders of the Nixon campaign that one of them would be the stronger of our candidates. That may have been one of their motives. I never really saw much evidence in that on the campaign trail, but it's one theory that was promulgated to beat Muskie and Humphrey so we can get at McGovern, who'll be a less powerful candidate in the general election.
Senator McGovern, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, then we'll be back. And then we will turn to our exclusive interview here at Democracy Now! With Jennifer Dorn. She was the target of many break-ins that were authorized by Mark Felt, Deep Throat, as number two man in the FBI. He ultimately was convicted for authorizing those break-ins and pardoned by President Reagan in the first months of his presidency. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, Freedom, Justice, and Equality by Stranger Cole, the music. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez on the line with us, Senator George McGovern, and Senator Mike Gravel in our Washington studio, Alaska senator from 1969 to 1981. He was the senator who read the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record. Juan Gonzalez.
Senator Gravel, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you, one of the revelations that Woodward and Bernstein came up with as a result of some of their contact with Mr. Felt was that Nixon's top aide, John Ehrlichman, oversaw a special covert unit known as the Plumbers that burglarized the office of the psychiatrist of Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers. You are the senator who read the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record. Your reaction to the revelations of the last few days?
Surprised, like everybody else, and delighted that he's come forward in his lifetime, because he's really shown us what a whistleblower, a great whistleblower, can do for the benefit of the country.
Can you talk, Senator Gravel, about the significance of Watergate and also what it means for government then and today?
Secrecy is endemic to government activities. Tragically so, it's part of human nature. And there's only one anecdote to it, and that is, for occasionally a courageous person will step forward and put his career and life at risk to tell the truth to the American people. Tell the truth via the media, obviously. And that's what Mr. Felt did, was to recognize that in his capacity, and this is where a lot of the charges right now are, well, he should have stayed within the law and performed his duties. Well, who was he reporting to? He was reporting to Gray, the head of the FBI, who was nothing but a Nixon hack. He was reporting to the Attorney General, who later, John Mitchell, who later went to jail for conspiring with Richard Nixon, or to the president himself. So he was boxed in and had no alternative, if he was going to out this criminality of the White House, but to then use a friend of long standing that he could trust to pay out the information to keep the investigation alive and let these reporters do their job.
But isn't it, in a sense, ironic that the man who was a whistleblower over burglaries conducted by the White House was himself later convicted for burglaries that he supervised against anti-war and other activists in the among the American people?
Well, there's no question that he probably broke the law. But keep in mind, they're tagging him. Hoover was alive then when this happened, and he was the number two man. So obviously he was following the orders of Hoover, and Hoover was now dead. And so he was the next person in line to go ahead and convict. They thought at the time, accurately or not, that the weathermen who had owned up to committing some acts of terrorism on our soil, they thought that there was some foreign influence, and therefore they thought they had legality on their side to go ahead and do these surreptitious entries into the homes of some of these weather people. Now, that they were convicted and pardoned, keep in mind, they were pardoned with a great deal of outpouring of support from agents of the FBI. Apparently, Felt was very popular among the rank and file of the FBI, which says something about the man. But keep in mind, he was a protege of Herbert Hoover, who I think in many respects was very dastardly. But by the same token, J. Edgar Hoover, who did want to protect the integrity of the FBI from invasion by the hacks of the Nixon White House.
Well, let's turn to that story of the break-ins that the FBI authorized. On Tuesday, the family of Mark Felt publicly said they hoped history would view him as a hero for being Deep Throat. This is Felt's grandson, Nick Jones.
The family believes my grandfather, Mark Felt Sr., is a great American hero who went well above and beyond the call of duty, at much risk to himself, to save his country from a horrible injustice. We all sincerely hope the country will see him this way as well.
But not everyone is praising Mark Felt. A group of former Nixon aides are criticizing him for betraying the Nixon administration. Former Nixon advisor Pat Buchanan says Felt was corrupt for revealing White House secrets. G. Gordon Liddy also criticized Felt. Liddy organized the break-in of the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate complex.
He's certainly not a hero because a law enforcement official who obtains knowledge of the commission of a crime and has the essence of it and who did it and so forth is ethically obliged to go to the grand jury and bring his evidence in there so that an indictment can be obtained and justice can be done. He didn't do that. Instead, he selectively leaked it to a single news source.
That was G. Gordon Liddy. Liddy himself was convicted of conspiracy, burglary, and illegal wiretapping in connection with Watergate. He served 4.5 years in prison before having his 20-year sentence commuted by President Jimmy Carter.
While Felt's name will forever now be linked to helping expose the Watergate scandal, he is also connected to another dark moment in U.S. history, the FBI's counterintelligence program known as COINTELPRO. Under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI carried out an extensive campaign of surveillance and neutralization of political groups, including the Black Panthers, the American Indian Movement, the Young Lords, and Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
In 1980, Mark Felt, along with Edward Miller, became the highest-ranking FBI officials to be convicted of criminal charges since J. Edgar Hoover became head of the agency in 1924. The two officials were convicted by a jury of conspiring to violate the constitutional rights of American citizens for ordering FBI agents to secretly break into the homes of friends and relatives of the militant anti-war group, the Weather Underground. In September 1980, government prosecutors said in court that Felt's actions were a, quote, violation of the rights of all people of this country, violations that cannot and will not be tolerated as long as we have a Bill of Rights.
Felt and Miller were later pardoned by President Ronald Reagan, who credited them for bringing a, quote, end to the terrorism that was threatening our nation. In 1983, a federal judge ordered that Felt and Miller's criminal record be swept clean. Felt and Miller were the only FBI officials convicted in connection to COINTELPRO. Felt never denied the break-ins, but argued that they were done in the name of national security. He claimed that the Weather Underground had extensive ties to foreign powers and that break-ins were part of a foreign intelligence investigation. We're joined now in our studio by Jennifer Dorn, who was the target of FBI break-ins ordered by Felt. Her sister, Bernadine Dorn, was a founder of the Weather Underground and was on the run from the federal government during the 1970s. Government documents show that FBI agents repeatedly broke into Jennifer's home. In 1978, she filed a civil suit against Felt and Miller. The suit was settled in 1983 out of court.
We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Jennifer Dorn.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
Well, it's good to have you with us. When you heard that Deep Throat had been revealed and it was Mark Felt, your response?
My response was that history needed to be reviewed, re-looked at, re-examined, and this was a great time to look at the comparisons between what happened in the early 70s to me and many others and what, in fact, is happening now around Iraq and the building of a counterintelligence system.
Tell us about what happened to you. Where did you live?
I lived in New York primarily. I was based in New York. I was very, very active in the anti-war movement and in support of the Black Freedom Movement and the Puerto Rican liberation struggle. And I was followed night and day by the FBI. I had my apartments, several apartments, wiretapped. Apartments next to me were rented by FBI agents who kept continuous 24-hour surveillance of every sound made in my apartment. I was followed up and down the streets. I would get a job. The FBI would go in after me, and I would then be fired from the job. It was a round-the-clock harassment.
Were you aware of it at the time?
I was aware of a lot of it. I was certainly aware of being followed a lot. I was assumed that perhaps my phones were tapped, and I had no idea of the level of extent under which I was being surveilled. I had no idea that break-ins were repeatedly happening into my apartments. I remember when I was pregnant with my firstborn feeling extremely vulnerable because I was being followed a great deal of the time. And then it was revealed when I received my Freedom of Information Act papers, over 200,000 documents, that there actually had been developed by Felt a plan to kidnap my son after I birthed in hopes of getting my sister to surrender. So my imagination was...
The FBI plans to kidnap your son?
Yes.
How did it say that in the documents?
It said that this was a plan that had been developed and ultimately was not implemented.
Well,
it's pretty amazing.
it became clear, I guess, in the early 1980s, the extent of this of the illegal break-ins and illegal activities. Wesley Swearingen, a former FBI agent, actually testified that he was basically a full-time burglar for many years.
Right, 238, at least he recorded.
At least 238 burglaries in Chicago and Los Angeles, and that in New York there was a special squad of the FBI, Squad 47, that was basically assigned to find the weathermen. And apparently J. Edgar Hoover was obsessed with the weathermen, as were L. Patrick Gray, who then succeeded him. So the presumption was that the main reason that they were surveilling you so much and burglarizing your apartments was in search for Bernadine Dorn and her relationship to the weathermen, right?
I think that was the primary assumption. But in fact, what was happening was great surveillance and breaking of the law, illegal acts directed, authorized, built, engineered by Felt against the entire movement of protest. I think it's important, especially when I hear the earlier clips, it's being billed as Watergate brought down Nixon. My view is that the victory of the Vietnamese people and the vibrant movement in this country brought down Nixon. And the whistleblowing to have Watergate be exposed was critical. But we have to set the record straight historically. And in fact, what was being done to me, which is severe and continual, was small compared to the strategy that was implemented by Felt against other movements in this country.
I wanted to go for a minute to your sister, Bernadine Dorn. She doesn't join us in the studio or on the phone, but I wanted to go back to an excerpt of a 2002 documentary called The Weather Underground. It goes back way back to the news clips.
My name is Bernadine Dorn, and I was part of The Weather Underground from, well, it's hard to say when it started, 1970 to 1980. It's underground for 11 years.
There's no way to be committed to nonviolence in the middle of the most violent society that history's ever created. I'm not committed to nonviolence in any way.
That was Bernadine Dorn more recently and going back in those last comments in 1969. So they were pursuing you to get her. Did they succeed?
Did they succeed in getting her? No. They never did. And they were also pursuing me because I represented one of many, many, many millions of voices in this country that said no more. We were not going to stand for this war continuing in Vietnam. We were not going to stand for the extreme repression that was coming down against the Puerto Rican and Black and American independence movement. Really important that I was a symbol, and what happened to me was real in search of my sister. But that COINTELPRO, which Mark Felt is responsible for really implementing, was much wider than we ever have come to really understand.
Now, Mark Felt was ultimately convicted. Government prosecuted him.
Yes, he actually was.
You didn't testify at that trial.
I was not asked to testify, and it's interesting that the concrete thing that he could be convicted of were burglaries against me and several other people, break-ins, which were documented and recorded, so we had evidence to convince him.
But you were cited many times in the
many
trial.
Times. And in fact, after his conviction, he was pardoned by Reagan's first act in office, and we conducted a civil suit. And the reason that I participated in a civil suit against Mark Felt was because I did feel that his actions against me, the break-ins, were just the tip of the iceberg. And the only way to really get public attention and knowledge to what was happening to the Black movement and to the Puerto Rican movement in this country were to get at these documents.
What did you settle for?
We settled for minimal. It was essentially closed. We settled for basically lawyer's fees. By the early 80s, the ability to get FOIA files was already being restricted, and now it's seriously jeopardized as a way to have some transparency or accountability for what this counterintelligence network is about in this country.
Well, you know, I can testify, having been a member of the Young Lords back in those days,
right,
that the numerous break-ins that occurred in the homes of Young Lord members, including my own back in 1972, clearly were political break-ins, and that people that the things that were stolen had nothing to do with valuable goods of a drug dealer, but were clearly break-ins looking for material and information. And I remember back in 1972 when I was arrested by 13 FBI agents for violating the selective service laws at the time and refusing to serve in Vietnam. I was questioned for about 8 hours at FBI headquarters before I was arraigned. And virtually all the questions that the FBI agents asked me were not about the Young Lords, not about the selective service, but were, when was the last time you saw Bernadine Dorn? When was the last time you saw Robbie Roth? When was the last time you saw Mark Rudd? They were obsessed with finding the weathermen and being able to break a group that they saw sending a bad signal of white progressive Americans and radical Americans uniting with the black and Latino liberation struggles at the time.
So when you heard that Mark Felt was Deep Throat, I bet you haven't realized for all of these years that you had a connection to Deep Throat, Juan.
Right, that he authorized some break-ins of my apartments.
Well, yes. I was repeatedly stopped and was brought into station saying I was Bernadine Dorn, just as a form of harassment, obviously. She was safely tucked in the underground. But I think the ability, our being white, educated, that we could get into the Pentagon or the Capitol or any place we wanted. We were supposed to be the future dream of what they wanted, the government wanted to do. And instead, we decided to ally ourselves, rightly so, with the struggle for justice in this world. And so the passion to get us was intense.
President Reagan said when he pardoned Mark Felt, 4 years ago, thousands of draft evaders and others who violated the selective service laws were unconditionally pardoned by my predecessor. He was talking about Carter. Reagan said, America was generous to those who refused to serve their country in the Vietnam War. We can be no less generous to two men who acted on high principle to bring an end to the terrorism that was threatening our nation. Your response, Jennifer Dorn.
I would really ask who is committing the terrorism, and that what we were doing was legitimate protest for our civil rights and for rights of people around the world, and that this has to be preserved today. I mean, if anything, the story of Mark Felt coming out now should be for people in this country to really look at the challenge to our civil rights, what's happening with this immoral war in Iraq, and ask for an accountability. That's what needs to be done. So that's the legacy of Mark Felt. The legacy should be to look at his responsibility for acts that authorized repression, murder, imprisonment of people for life, Herman Bell, David Gilbert, Leonard Peltier, and took away civil rights from people who were dissenting. This is supposed to be Democracy Now.
It's interesting you raise Leonard Peltier, because in his memoirs, Mark Felt's memoir, The FBI Pyramid, he wrote of his involvement in overseeing the activities of the FBI during the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee by members of the American Indian Movement. AIM members have accused him of having a significant role in hatching an illegal counterintelligence program targeting AIM.
Right. So this should be the legacy of Mark Felt, and this should be the historical record that gets set straight. I do support people whistleblowing. I think it's been critical in terms of what's going on in Iraq, torture, Guantanamo Bay. All of these things have to be brought out. But we need a balanced view of his responsibility.
Well, Jennifer Dorn, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Jennifer Dorn here in our studio at Democracy Now! And if you want to see the transcripts, you can go to our website at democracynow.org and pass on information about Democracy Now! To people around the world who might not know about it. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll go to a break, then we'll return with investigative journalist David Wise.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. A man in a trench coat, badge out, laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap in a pigpen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie comes fleetfoot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says the men say they must bust an early man. Orders from the DA. Look out, kid, don't matter what you did. But walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those that care out of fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash your clean clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Oh, get sick, get well, hang around the inkwell. Hang bell, hard to tell if anything is gonna sell. Try hard, get bought, get back, ride rail, get jail, jump bail. Join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit by losers, cheaters, six-time users, hanging around the theaters. Girl by the whirlpools, looking for a new fool. Don't follow leaders, or watch your parking meters.
Subterranean Homesick Blues by Bob Dylan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. And just before we go to investigative journalist David Wise, with Jennifer Dorn still in our studio, I think there was one last story we wanted to hear from you, and that was a trophy that the burglars got when they broke into your apartment.
Right. Apparently, on one of the break-ins, they took a pair of my underwear and put it in a glass case and gave it as a trophy gift to Mark Felt.
And this was discovered how?
This was discovered, it was actually leaked to me by someone in the press years later who had gone over my FOIA files.
Jennifer Dorn, thanks for joining us. Juan?
We are now joined by investigative journalist David Wise. He's the co-author of The Invisible Government, a number one bestseller about the CIA. He's also the author of Night Mover, Mole Hunt, The Spy Who Got Away, The American Police State, and The Politics of Lying. In 1981, he wrote a column in the New York Times criticizing President Reagan for pardoning Mark Felt, the man who we now know was Deep Throat.
David Wise began his column by writing, quote, President Reagan's pardon of two high Federal Bureau of Investigation officials who were convicted of authorizing illegal break-ins sends a clear message to the intelligence agencies. The President of the United States approves of government burglaries. One can visualize the intelligence operators breaking out the champagne at FBI headquarters in the J. Edgar Hoover building and across the river at the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley, Virginia. The meaning of Mr. Reagan's action was immediately grasped by Mark Felt, one of the pardoned FBI officials. He said this is going to be the biggest shot in the arm for the intelligence community for a long time. Again, that quote from a piece, an op-ed piece that appeared in the New York Times that was written by David Wise, who is in the studio with us in Washington. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us, David.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about that moment when Mark Felt, now we know as Deep Throat, was pardoned by President Reagan?
Well, I was not invited to drink any of that champagne, you can be sure. But I did feel that given what he had been convicted of and another FBI official, Ed Miller, had been convicted of, they weren't sentenced to jail time. They were fined a total of $8,500, I believe. And so they weren't going to prison, and I felt that therefore the conviction could stand because it was sending the wrong message about illegal break-ins. And in that same article, I quoted from William Pitt the Elder about the poorest man in England in his humble cottage can defy the crown. That, you know, the roof may be frail and the wind may blow through it and the storm may enter and the wind may enter, but the King of England may not enter. And that's what the Fourth Amendment is all about. And of course, the break-ins were not defensible and they were illegal. And indeed, the two officials were convicted for that.
Well, David Wise, in some of the early reporting, there's been suggestions that the original whistleblowing of Mr. Felt may not have been as altruistic as suggested, because he himself was upset over having been passed over for FBI director after J. Edgar Hoover's death. Your take on that?
Well, it's very difficult to see. Do we know ourselves? Do we know anyone? Very difficult to peer into the mind of a person to know motivations. So I'm very leery of trying to ascribe motives. He may have been, undoubtedly was, irritated and angered that he'd been passed over and that the head of the FBI was L. Patrick Gray, who distinguished himself by burning evidence with the Christmas trash, important Watergate evidence. And Mark Felt must have felt that after his career, he deserved to be named as the successor to J. Edgar Hoover. On the other hand, it's clear from this morning's Washington Post, where Bob Woodward is writing about how he first met Mark Felt as a very young man. He, Woodward, was a very young man, and they met in the White House, where Woodward was in the Navy and was assigned to bring over some materials at the White House. Felt was waiting to see someone, and they struck up a conversation. And so it is now clear for the first time that their relationship did not begin with the shooting of George Wallace, which Woodward had previously indicated. He called Mark Felt up when he was a young reporter about that, and then later in Watergate. It went way back to an earlier time, and so they had a continuing relationship because of this chance meeting in the White House and Woodward's ability to ingratiate himself with Mark Felt. So if that's true, and I have no reason to doubt it, and it's all over page one of the Washington Post this morning, then it may be that Felt's motivation was to help this young man to whom he had taken a shine, and that was part of their long-term relationship.
We're talking to investigative reporter David Wise, who continues to do his investigations. His specialty is the intelligence agencies and cultivating sources within them, breaking news right until now. David Wise is one of those, by the way, is the person who broke the story of Curveball, who was the source, one of the sources for Powell, then Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech at the United Nations alleging weapons of mass destruction. I wanted to go to this issue of anonymous sources, because so often Deep Throat is used as an example of why they're very important, vindicating many reporters today who use anonymous sources in a very different way to not name government officials who basically use reporters to spread lies like weapons of mass destruction. Your comments.
Well, let me talk a little about the Curveball matter and tell you how it came about and why I think it was important. This was spreading information that was true about something that wasn't true. And what I mean is this. Last year, I was one of four writers asked by Vanity Fair, a magazine which has been rather in the news these days because they broke the story of Deep Throat's identity as Mark Felt. I was asked to participate in a story we wrote just a year ago called The Path to War. It was about how we got into this terrible mess in Iraq. And one of the sources that I was able to interview, I will say that it was an official of the government. And this source said to me that there was a person who was in Germany and whom the CIA had not been permitted to interview by the German intelligence authorities, and that this source later identified as Curveball, because I didn't know and we didn't print his name at that time because we didn't know it, but it later emerged. He was talking about the same person we now know as Curveball, a wonderfully appropriate name for the information he provided. The information he provided, which is now shown to be entirely suspect, was that he had personally witnessed a production run of biological weapons, germ weapons, at a mobile laboratory inside Iraq. You remember there was a great deal of fuss about mobile laboratories, which, as it turns out, didn't exist. And so Colin Powell, in February of 2003, on the eve of the Iraq War, relied on this man, this Curveball, as our story indicated, as one of four witnesses, anonymous sources. The government was using anonymous sources, who knew something about the so-called biological mobile laboratory production, which was a fantasy. We now know it didn't happen. Colin Powell relied on that in a speech that seemed at the time quite persuasive to many Americans. The anonymous source who told me about this, I think, was doing a service to not only the readers of Vanity Fair, but anyone else who picked up that story. We now know that much of what Powell was saying wasn't true. And in the case of Curveball, I think I've demonstrated that this was an important piece of information to put out to the public. And it was a source who asked me not to be named. And I had to agree, you know, when someone provides you with information and says, on condition that you not name that person, you have to abide by that understanding.
And in terms of the lessons for the climate, political climate today, and the government's increasing expansion of its ability to conduct surveillance of American citizens, any lessons from the Watergate era that would be valuable for our listeners to grasp?
Well, I think there is a parallel between that era and the concern over terrorism today. We've always in this country, in my lifetime, have had an enemy, a perceived enemy, whether it was communism during the Cold War, then the Weather Underground that you've been talking about today, and now the terrorists from the Middle East. There's always been a perceived enemy, and there's always been a tension between the desire to protect against that perceived enemy and the freedoms that our Constitution and our way of life tries to protect. And that tension we can see now, today, with the concern over the USA Patriot Act, for example, and the abuses that were mentioned earlier at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib prison. There is always a tug of war between the forces that want to protect our liberties and the forces that see the outside threat or the internal threat as the real problem. And really, the problem is to keep our eye on the ball to preserve our own way of life, our own values, because if we lose that, we become just like this perceived enemy. And I remember the wonderful quote during the Vietnam era of the military officer who told a reporter, "We had to destroy the village in order to save it." So that I think is what we have to keep in mind.
David Wise, we want to thank you very much for being with us, an investigative reporter based in Washington, D.C. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, and Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers, and we wish Ryan Abernathy a wonderful future. And thanks for joining us and being part of Democracy Now! You can go to our website at democracynow.org for transcripts and to hear and see Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.